Our episodes deal with serious and often distressing incidents. Listener discretion is advised.
I'm Jess, and this is Skinwalker.
Edith McAlinden was from the south side of Glasgow. She had endured a troubled life. She was, by adulthood, what might be termed now as a casual sex worker. In short, she sometimes sold her body to those who would pay her when cash was tight. Making ends meet with whatever you had to hand was a skill learned at the coalface of poverty as she had grown up, and Edith lived her mantra. To earn her keep, she was not only involved in sex work, but also heavily involved in petty criminality and had a reputation for stealing. She was aggressive too, and fought to defend her patch, small as it may have been, having been convicted more than a handful of times for assaults throughout her life. Edith had not been dealt a great hand in life. Chaos had always reigned supreme for her. Lack of money, violence, abuse of drugs and alcohol, petty crime, occasional bouts of homelessness, and turbulent personal relationships are seldom the basis of a happy and fruitful life, and so too it proved for Edith. Even when she tried to lay foundations for a better life, circumstances and her own personal flaws often got in the way. She had a son when she was 22 years old, who she had named John. Edith, given her own personal circumstances, had in time not proven a particularly safe and involved mother for John. Although she undoubtedly loved him, John was eventually removed to the care of the state. John did, however, keep in friendly contact with his mother as he had grown up, whenever she was deemed fit to be involved in his life. The suitability of Edith to visit John largely depended on where she was staying at that time. Edith had been homeless at various periods in her life, and having no fixed address meant that the social work department in charge of John's welfare had no easy way of making contact, and an even harder time establishing trust with her. Similarly, the array of so-called friends and boyfriends who had passed through her life often had questionable motives and loyalties. By late 2003, and at the age of 36, little had changed for Edith, save for a few grey hairs sprouting in her head and the faint outline of the weary lines of age appearing on her face. She found herself once again before the local court, having gotten herself arrested, then convicted and sentenced to imprisonment once more, this time on a charge of serious assault. It would be a lonely year for Edith in Cornton Vale's women prison, before she would once again see the dim light of a Scottish sun on Saturday, October 16, 2004. On the day of her release, Edith celebrated how she always had, with alcohol and friends. She met up with a casual boyfriend she had been seeing prior to her arrest, David Gillespie, at a flat owned by a friend of the pair on Dixon Avenue, Cross Hill, in Glasgow's south side. Gillespie was a 42-year-old man who had known Edith throughout her years casually selling sex. Over the course of the day, the pair had gotten raucously drunk on cheap cider and buckfast wine. They were joined by the two tenants of the flat, Anthony Coyle, 71, and Ian Mitchell, 67. Ian Mitchell was also the landlord of the property. Edith had known Ian for years. He was an old face in the area and had always looked out for her and shown her kindness. She even referred to him lovingly as Pops. This was the reason they had headed over to his property for a drink in the first place. For a first taste of freedom, being around the man you love and one of the few people who had ever seemed to be on your side sounded like the ideal place to be. Unfortunately, chaos took hold once more. As they had gotten more and more drunk, Edith and David Gillespie began to argue. It had become particularly heated at one point, and the shouting, screaming and sounds of broken quiet continued for some time. So much so that a neighbour through the wall, James Sweeney, became alarmed by the commotion. Eventually, the general din subsided and James went back about his night, thinking little more of the disturbance. That was not to be the last of his involvement in the events at 28 Dixon Avenue, however. 2 hours after the last of the noise had subsided, he heard a frantic banging on his front door. When he opened, he knew the face at the door immediately. Everyone in the area knew Edith's face. What he hadn't seen on it before was the look of sheer horror which covered her as she said softly to him, "Something's happened, Jim." She pleaded with him to come with her back to the flat. As she explained further, she told James Sweeney that she had blacked out, and when she awoke, something horrific had taken place. It was at this point, as he agreed to come over to the adjacent flat, that James Sweeney noticed just how much blood had stained the front of Edith McAlinden's clothes and shoes. Edith put the key in the lock for the flat and turned it. What met James Sweeney inside was one of the most horrific crime scenes in Scottish police history. The walls and floor had become almost painted in deep red venous blood. 3 men lay in various positions around the flat, clearly long dead. Their bodies were battered, bruised and covered in the same dark red substance which painted every surface around them. Alongside a haphazard scattering of makeshift weaponry, which bore signs of use and the blood of the men, the floor was covered in rubbish, with glass bottles and bin bags spread across the floor. James Sweeney was struck dumb. Eventually, he recovered some small amount of voice and shouted at Edith, "Did you do this? What the hell has happened?" Edith never responded. She simply made her way over to the lifeless body of David Gillespie, huddled in against him where he lay on the sofa, and began to sob. James Sweeney took the opportunity to breathe fresh air and ran to the local pub for assistance. While there, he used their phone to dial 999 and alert the police in the early hours of the Sunday morning. Police officers and paramedics descended on the scene almost immediately, having been fed a distressing report that 3 adult male victims were lying dead from apparent violent wounds in the same Southside flat. Knowing from the report of the disarray within the flat that there was a chance of disturbing evidence in the house, a scene of crime camera woman, Cheryl Nixon, was sent in first. Edith McAlinden lay sprawled over David Gillespie, screaming "Wake up!" at him from mere centimetres away. Unsurprisingly, given his blood-soaked clothing, he made no response. As the camera panned out over the room, it caught sight of the other 2 men, who appeared in their twilight years, laying on the floor of the very same room. The paramedics first checked the 2 men on the floor for signs of life. The first bore the hallmarks of a severe beating and was pronounced dead. The second man had the same outcome, with the paramedics noting that he looked as though he had been burnt. Then, they had to do the same for the man on the sofa beneath Edith McAlinden. As she was asked to relinquish her grip on the man, she fought back before the police officers stepped in to escort her out of the house and allow the paramedics to do their duty. Edith then stood in the corner and took a swig from a bottle of alcohol before throwing it in the direction of Ian Mitchell's lifeless body. She then began to verbally abuse the officers before also shouting curses at the dead body of her lover. After getting her into a forensic suit, she was placed under arrest for questioning. The one thing that struck the officers was the sheer volume of violence which had clearly taken place within the flat. The cause of death for the man on the sofa was clearly blood loss, and the gash on his thigh area could have accounted for that. It would not have taken much more than a moment of anger for such a wound to happen. However, the other two men had quite clearly been subjected to significant and sustained violence using a multitude of weaponry. Among the potential weapons which lay bloodstained on the floor were a hammer, a golf club, a baseball bat, lumps of wood, and an electric drill. Across the road, a bloodied knife was discovered hidden in a hedge. The woman who stood before them looked like a prime suspect because she was covered in blood and in the location, but it was hard to square the small lady in front of them with the wanton violence and destruction around them. When they then found out that Ian Mitchell and Anthony Coyle had both spent their adult years doing manual work, Edith overpowering them herself seemed an even more remote possibility. Inside the investigation room, Edith McAlinden was questioned thoroughly. She protested her innocence, claiming to have blacked out and woken up to the devastation around her, but this was quickly dismissed by those investigating the crime. Edith McAlinden was involved, of that they had no doubt. Having spoken to James Sweeney, they knew she had been covered in blood when she had sought his assistance. He had also mentioned to them seeing significant amounts of blood on her jeans and trainers, something which potentially pointed to her moving around the flat while it was being covered in blood, rather than simply waking up to the devastation around her. If she had woken up and walked through it, the blood would have been more likely to have gotten on the soles of her shoes or feet, depending on what she was wearing. The investigators also knew, however, that it was impossible that Edith had done all of this on her own and posed this to her. She steadfastly denied her involvement and the involvement of any other parties that she knew of. Edith was then passed to the Procurator Fiscal, where she was informed in a private hearing on Monday, October 18, that she was to be charged with the murder of David Gillespie and held on remand pending trial. She made no plea and was returned to custody. No mention was made of Anthony Coyle or Ian Mitchell, but the police were hard at work on rectifying that. Having exhausted their key witnesses, the police next issued a request for assistance through the media, as Edith must have, in their words, had assistance from two or three other large men. The story was primetime news and splashed across every headline nationwide. When speaking anonymously, one police officer remarked, "It was like a house of blood." This then gave rise to a sensationalist nickname, which the mainstream media proceeded to use for almost every headline relating to the case throughout its life cycle in the public eye. Before running the story, the local paper, the Daily Record, doorstepped James Sweeney. When asked what the situation was like within the house, he replied, There was blood everywhere. It was hard to make out who they were. The television and print media ran the story extensively to catch the offender or offenders at large who had so far escaped justice. The breakthrough the police were looking for soon came to them when they received a call from a local lad named Brian Gallagher. Brian Gallagher had spent much of his life in the purview of the state care system, and given his precarious living situation in 2004, being a teen without a responsible guardian, he was living in a secure accommodation provided for him. In this facility, there were several other teenagers who had similarly troubling personal circumstances. Brian Gallagher stayed in a room adjacent to the son of Edith, John McAlinden. Brian had gotten to know John through their relative proximity within the building and also their closeness in age. A few nights after the attacks on Dixon Avenue, which were the talk of the town within the accommodation, John McAlinden had come into Brian's room to chat. As they chatted, John got more and more animated, before finally telling Brian a story he was unlikely to forget in a hurry. John McAlinden plainly stated to Brian that he had stabbed a man in the legs for attempting to rape his mother. John then went on to say that him and his brother had tortured and beaten a man to death, giving excruciating levels of details to the listening Brian. He then finally added that he had also killed his mum's boyfriend. Brian sat shocked and quickly tried to bring his conversation with John to a close. By the time he got him out of the room, he knew he had to report what he had just been told. The following morning, to avoid any suspicion from John McAlinden, he phoned in to police, revealing what he had been told by John. When investigators got wind of the new development in the case, John McAlinden was brought in for questioning immediately. John didn't do well in stressful situations. He had little life experience and few role models. In the room against two seasoned investigators, he didn't really stand a chance. He crumbled and almost immediately named his brother, who he had mentioned to Brian Gallagher, as being Jamie Gray. Jamie Gray was another boy from the residential home who was at the time only 16 years old. John McAlinden and Jamie Gray weren't the burly men the investigators were expecting, but if David Gillespie was dead first, it was well within the realms of possibility that the two young boys and Edith McAlinden would have been capable of overpowering the two pension-aged men remaining within the flat, even if they had been manual labourers. The main problem that the police were running into was establishing causation and the chain of events which led to the sheer chaos they had walked into at 28 Dixon Avenue. How had the day went from a celebration to a bloodbath? No one was telling them. Each individual would give them scraps, but the whole story refused to fit neatly. In the end, given the sheer volume of forensic evidence within the flat and within the clothes recovered from each individual involved, the police informed the Procurator Fiscal's office that they did not intend to establish individual fault, but if it were agreeable to the Fiscal, they would charge the three accused on all three counts of murder. It would then be in the capable hands of the Fiscal's office to determine, based on the evidence that the police had gathered, precisely what had taken place that night. It was a gamble. There was a litany of forensic evidence, but the standard is to prove a case beyond all reasonable doubt. If the jury didn't buy it, then there was every chance that a mistrial could be called, or guilty parties could walk away declared innocent and justice go unserved. But the Fiscal's office agreed. As the trial date approached in May of 2005, the resolve of the three accused had held. The trial was to proceed, with all three accused facing three murder charges each. This resolve, though, broke early in the trial when the video showing the disturbing reality of the flat was shown to the jury of 9 women and 6 men. The severity of the video was acknowledged by the judge, Lady Dorian, who stated to the jury she had sympathy that they would need to view it, but it was vital to the case at hand, so they would do so. Prior to the video being shown, the three in the dock had been laughing, joking and smiling as the trial had progressed. After the fact, there was blind panic on their faces. Their lawyers promptly made contact with the fiscal to state that there would be no need to establish a chain of events in the trial because their clients were willing to offer this information up on one condition, that each would only agree to take responsibility for one murder of the three. Edith McAlinden would plead guilty to David Gillespie's killing. John McAlinden would plead guilty to that of Ian Mitchell, and Jamie Gray would plead guilty to the murder of Anthony Coyle. In truth, sometimes the court system operates as a function of justice in name only. It is oftentimes more like the business of punishment, and to facilitate a speedy resolution, they take what they can get. In short, the fiscal's office relented. They had taken a gamble early on and weren't willing to do so twice. It was all about getting a conviction on each party, even if it meant the entirety of the truth wasn't what was displayed when the case went before the High Court in Dunfermline. The story that emerged from the three accused had several points in common, which were then used to formulate a best version of what truly took place within the flat late on Saturday, October 16, 2004. The story as believed it had happened went as follows. Edith and David had begun to argue aggressively as the day had wore on. Growing tired of the argument and with no thought as to the consequences of her actions, Edith McAlinden picked up a knife and repeatedly began to stab David Gillespie in the thighs. The wounds poured blood onto the floor of the room as the knife had severed the femoral artery twice. At the time of this incident, the only people in the flat were David Gillespie, Edith, Ian Mitchell and Anthony Coyle. Ian and Anthony were frantically trying to administer aid to David while Edith panicked and stormed around the house. Edith then told them she had a plan and would try to save David's life. Expecting a call to 999, Ian and Anthony were shocked when she instead phoned her son John and begged him to come and help. She then pleaded with Ian Mitchell to pay for her son's taxi fare as he had no money on him. Believing the boy was coming to help assist in the situation and administer aid to David Gillespie, he agreed and got cash ready for the taxi. John quickly arrived on the scene and had brought his friend from the residential home, Jamie Gray. As David Gillespie died on the floor before them, John McAlinden realised his mother was now a murderer and the men around him were witnesses. Loyalty ran deep in John's veins, and he wasn't going to see his mother go back to prison. John McAlinden and Jamie Gray decided to leave no witnesses but themselves and turned on Ian Mitchell. He ran back in a panic, but was unable to fend off the two young men as they accosted him. John McAlinden stabbed him repeatedly before he then allegedly kicked him in the head multiple times. Then, Pops, as Edith McAlinden called him, lay dead on the floor of the Crosshill flat. Anthony Coyle was a man who could live off his wits. A lifetime as a labourer had taught him a thing or two, and he knew when a man had to move. As the rabid pair of John and Jamie set about his friend of many years, He knew he could do little to help, but could try and make it to safety. He ran for his room and managed to lock the door behind him. He then heard the thud of boots and fists hitting off of his door. Along with this, there was angry shouts telling him what was to come, but the door held. His relief, however, was short-lived. John McAlinden searched the house before taking a drill to the door of the man's room and removed the lock from the outside. The pair burst through, and Anthony Coyle made one last dash for freedom. He was knocked to the ground a few feet outside of his room and nearby to the body of his longtime friend, Ian Mitchell. Jamie Gray then savagely beat the pensioner to death with a golf club. To test that the pair were dead, they boiled a kettle and poured boiling hot water on the pair. As they suspected, the pensioners did not move. The pair then agreed a plan of action with Edith McAlinden, then fled. The trial nonetheless took a number of days, despite the overwhelming evidence and the newly tendered guilty pleas, as the court was still to determine an appropriate punishment for the three guilty parties in the dock. Victim impact statements were read, including one from Violet Cahill, who had been Mr. Gillespie's partner for 20 years before splitting up 3 years prior to the crimes, whereby she said she could not comprehend the killings. She stated, "I hope they rot in hell for what they've done to two old men and my ex-partner. Justice should be done for the horrific things that they've done. Knives, axes, drills and kettles." They said they put boiling water over them to see if they were dead. How evil can people get? She then finished her statement with a single line. "Edith McAlinden, in particular, is a monster." The families of Ian Mitchell and Anthony Coyle released a joint statement which was read on their behalf, which stated, "They were the best of friends and did not deserve to be murdered." In turn, the defendants were given their opportunity to show some level of mitigation which they felt should be applied to their case. Edith McAlinden had evidence presented of her addictions, while John McAlinden's troubled childhood and lack of role models were presented to the court. One of the few resonating factors in mitigation in the room was that Jamie Gray had never previously been in trouble with the law and had only run away from his home in Linwood, just outside of Glasgow, in the weeks running up to the events within the so-called House of Blood. In the end, the court sentenced Edith McAlinden to 13 years, and 12 years were given to both John McAlinden and Jamie Gray, likely due to their youth. The sentence shocked the public, given that it seemed incredibly light based on the fact the murders appeared almost motiveless and were incredibly barbaric and violent. There were small protests from the families of the victims, which were publicised at the time, where David Gillespie's daughter, Shirley Ann, stated that anything less than 20 years did not reflect the severity of the crimes. Despite this, the convictions were upheld as lawful. Edith McAlinden was sent to serve her sentence at Caunton Vale, while the two younger accused were to initially be taken to Polmont Young Offenders Institution before transferring to an adult population prison at the appropriate time. In prison, Edith McAlinden revelled in her reputation. She took lovers and threatened the other inmates. According to one source, whenever she was accosted or threatened in kind, she would retort by stating, "You can't threaten me. Do you know who I am? I'm the woman from the House of Blood." Edith McAlinden's choice in company goes some way to showing how she elected to take her life forward after her conviction, having had sexual relationships with a famous female drug dealer and Pamela Gourley, who was found guilty of the senseless murder of Melanie Sturton in Aberdeen in October 1999. Edith also took up poetry while inside and had her work displayed at Caunton Vale in an end-of-year exhibit. She last appeared in the public domain in 2018 and at that time was still incarcerated. John McAlinden served his sentence without remark, being released early in 2016. He appeared to have turned his life around, barring one arrest for domestic assault, which was later reduced to a charge of threatening and abusive behaviour against his partner, Lauren Cassidy, in late 2018. McAlinden allegedly shouted, "Get out of my fucking way, you bitch," at Cassidy as they walked down Elmbank Street in Glasgow city centre just before 1 a.m, before then striking her phone out of her hands. The charge was later deferred for sentencing by the courts after Cassidy supported McAlinden throughout. As of April 2021, there have been no further publicly published updates. Jamie Gray disappeared from the public record in the aftermath of the crime, and his current whereabouts are unknown.